From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, no garbage pickup in Flint as the mayor and city council fight over which trash hauler should get the contract.
Most people here in Flint are just sick and tired of the politics altogether. We don't want to really support anybody. We just want resolution to the problem.
Helping property owners look past the green curtain and really know what's living on their land.
It's hard to manage and steward species or habitats when you don't know what you have.
A Hamtramck mom turns an Etsy hobby into a thriving purse-making business and gives jobs to immigrants from all around the world.
From all different cultures, all different walks of life, it's really fun to walk into our workshop and to see so many different people who look so different, but all in the same little small space.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If this is your trash collection day in Flint, that trash bin is going to be full tonight. That's because trash pickup has been canceled as Flint's mayor and city council fight over a new contract. Mayor Karen Weaver wanted to give the trash hauling contract to a company called Rizzo Environmental Services. It had the lowest bid. But instead, the city council opted to continue with Republic, the current trash hauler. The mayor vetoed the council vote. The council overrode the mayor's veto. Mayor Weaver then canceled trash pickup until further notice. A court hearing happened Friday, but Mayor Weaver was at the Democratic National Convention and she couldn't attend. But the judge declared there is, in his words, an obnoxious stench of political intrigue in this trash controversy. All sides are ordered back to court tomorrow. As this fighting plays out in City Hall and a courtroom, it's one more indignity for people in Flint. Mark Masters of TDM Realtors spoke to Stateside back in January, talking about the difficulties of trying to address the water problems for his 300 or so tenants. Mark, what are you hearing now from tenants about losing trash pickup?
So far, it's in its infancy, so it hasn't really gotten too bad at this moment. I did notice when I drove by earlier this morning on my way to work that there was a few bags of garbage already left on the front lawn of the city hall there, so I think by the end of the day, there might be even more bags left there from what I have been hearing of tenants coming here and paying their rent. Best ability is just try to secure the garbage as best as they can and try to ride out the storm. Hopefully, within a few days, we'll be back in business. But then again, it might take longer than that.
And so you're saying that you're hearing from tenants and you've seen it, that people are kind of saying, okay, City Hall, here you go. Here's my trash.
Yeah. I mean, they already went out there back in the height of the water crisis and filled up bathtubs with bottled water to show them how long it would take to take a human-sized bath. And that, of course, that took quite a few cases of water to even get remotely enough in a tub to take a bath. And now, yeah, you're absolutely right. The problem is it's not just the garbage out on City Hall. Is that we have a lot of vacant homes in our town, and I have a big feeling that people are just going to ride by these vacant homes and start piling garbage in these houses, which, of course, will create a lot of health issues as far as animals, rodents, bugs, so a lot of health issues. So they need to get their poop in a group and get this taken care of.
You know, I got to wonder, Mark, as tenants come in and pay their rent and talk about this garbage fight between the mayor and between city council, are you hearing people support one side or the other, Mayor Weaver and Rizzo versus city council and Republic?
You know, I haven't. Most people here in Flint are just sick and tired of the politics altogether. We don't want to really support anybody. We just want resolution to the problem. Miscommunications down there in City Hall. I spend more time bouncing around City Hall trying to figure out anything to help us out, and I just get past the buck. Nobody heard nothing. You know, one person says something, the other person says, well, I didn't get a memo on that, or I haven't heard that. And it's just there's a lot of conflict. Nobody likes anybody down at City Hall.
And the one paying the price for that seems to be residents.
Residents, taxpayers' money. And Flint is a very expensive place to live with no outcome I see in the future. There's barely any industry left here. Most of the big GM factories have left and they're being torn down by out-of-state people even. I mean, it's not even local companies doing the work. And you have truck and bus that's still here. Thank God, you know, that's supporting a few people. But at one time, Flint had over 200,000 people living here, and GM alone employed 80,000 of them. And now there's less than 100,000 people left in Flint and barely any GM left. And you got to think all those other jobs that left when GM left. I mean, everything from the grocery store to the, you know, small little mom and pop shops that supported all these GM workers are all gone. We had over five high schools. We're down to two high schools in Flint. Grand Blanc is the biggest school district now in Genesee County, with Davidson coming in second, and Flint is now third. So if that tells you anything, there's just not enough people here to support anything. So we're all fighting tooth and nail just to try to keep our nose above water, not just me as being a landlord, but just the tenant trying to live off of what they got as far as the little job they got or the welfare they have to live off of, and it's a very tough time.
Is there just kind of a ongoing water issues that you're having to deal with, too, with your tenants? Where are things for you there?
Well, it's tough. I mean, we have several locations through town that you as a person that lives here could stop, give your address out, request how much bottled water you need. They'll load you up. They'll offer free filters, test kits, and then you can go about your day. So what I've been doing is I've been going around in my truck, and I've been picking up usually about 20 cases of water is about what I can hold without getting too extreme, filters and test kits. And then when I go around to pick up rent from a lot of my tenants that don't have vehicles or a way to get bottled water, I will stop by and drop off several cases of water here and there, and filters and test kits as needed. And I also bring a lot of filters and test kits back to my office, so tenants come in and pay the rent can pick up a filter or a test kit if they take the bus. So, I mean, I've been trying to do everything I can to keep my tenants happy and keep them, of course, renting the house from me. That's how I make my money. So,
what would you say to the mayor and to city council if you had them in front of you right now, Mark?
That they need to all start working together really hard to resolve this issue and quit doing a lot of in-house fighting. They're really not even thinking about us anymore as the people that have to either live here or work here. They're just thinking about themselves at this point. It's getting really tough on all of us. I mean, it really makes it disappointing for me to come to work every day when it just makes my job that much harder having to deal with, you know, at first it used to be, is that a good neighborhood I'm moving into? You know, what's the crime rate like and stuff? Then it went to, is it Flint water? No, I'm waiting for them to say, am I going to get my garbage picked up? It seems like we take one step forward and then three back every time.
Mark Masters is with TDM Realtors in Flint. And as we said, a court hearing was held Friday. Mayor Weaver couldn't be there, but all sides are due back in court tomorrow. Mark, thank you so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
The only Democrat on the August primary ballot in Michigan's 8th congressional district hopes not to appear on the ballot in the general November election. The district includes northern Oakland County, Livingston County, and Ingham County. As WDET's Jake Neer reports, Democrats there have no way of knowing for whom they'll cast that ballot in November.
I'm in downtown Rochester right now asking people if they know who they're going to be voting for in the congressional race this year in the 8th district.
Not yet.
No.
No, I do not.
Not yet.
Do you know who you're voting for Congress this year?
For Congress? Mike Bishop is running against, trying to think of who he's running against. I would have to say I'm going to vote for whoever's running against Mike Bishop.
This should be an easy question, right? For Republicans, freshman Congressman and former State Senate Majority Leader Mike Bishop is running for re-election uncontested for that party's nomination. And for Democrats, isn't it this person?
Parents here are building better lives for their kids, for our community. They're doing their part. That's why I'm running for Congress.
Melissa Gilbert got into the race last year running largely on name recognition. You might know her from her years playing Laura Ingalls Wilder on the Little House on the Prairie TV series. As a candidate, she was a rock star fundraiser, but she also missed public appearances, avoided media interviews, and had some controversial financial and tax issues in her past. Gilbert withdrew from the race in May, citing medical complications from head and neck injuries. Now local party leaders have selected a replacement for Gilbert. Susanna Shkreli is a 29-year-old assistant Macomb County prosecutor from Clarkston. She's a political newcomer, but Democrats are excited about her record prosecuting crimes against children.
Being in the courtroom advocating on behalf of children who have been victims of physical and sexual abuse has given me the attitude, the strength, you know, and the disposition to tackle the tough fights in Congress that are not being tackled by Mike Bishop.
So Democrats should be able to say they'll vote for Shkreli, right? Well, first, party leaders must convince the Michigan Secretary of State's office to remove Gilbert's name from the November ballot and put Shkreli's name in her place. There's a section of state law that allows for candidates to have their names removed from the ballot due to health problems, but it hasn't been used since the 1950s. Congressman Bishop wasn't available to comment for this story, but his campaign spokesperson Stu Sandler says taking Gilbert's name off the ballot would set a dangerous precedent. He claims it could open up challenges against candidates who want to continue running but have physical ailments.
Congressman Dave Camp went through chemotherapy 4 years ago when he ran for re-election. Would someone be able to challenge someone going through chemotherapy?
There is a suggestion that Gilbert, who moved to Michigan from California in 2013, could change her residency to get off the ballot. The law is clear that candidates who move out of state can vacate the ballot. This would likely mean Gilbert and Democrats would avoid a protracted legal battle. But elections attorney John Peerich, who works largely on behalf of Republican political issues, points out that's not exactly easy.
You just can't say one day I'm no longer a resident of Michigan if you're still a registered to vote, still have a driver's license, still have a home, you still live here. You can't just say, well, now I'm not a resident any longer.
No matter who he's running against, Bishop's campaign says he's confident his record in Congress will be enough to get him reelected. And the 8th District definitely leans Republican. But for Democrats, the hope is that having a strong, active candidate will offer a contrast to Bishop and force him to spend more money. And if having Donald Trump at the top of the Republican ticket creates a Democratic wave down ballot, it could go a long way toward turning at least one seat in Congress from red to blue in November. I'm Jake Neer, WDET News.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It all began as a hobby, a little business on Etsy. But today, Better Life Bags is a thriving Hamtramck business that's changing the lives of the women who sew and make these custom-made bags, women from so many different cultures. Rebecca Smith is here with us. She's the founder of Better Life Bags. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thanks for having us.
So good to have you here. And we are happy to welcome Nadia Alakil. She's an immigrant to Michigan from Yemen, and she is the first person that Rebecca hired to work with her on Better Life Bags. Hello, Nadia.
Hello.
Good to have you here. Rebecca, when and why did you begin making bags?
Let's see. I was pregnant with my first son, so this was 2009. It's hard to think back that far. And it was just really, Etsy had just kind of come on the scene at the time. And I had just quit my job as a full-time teacher. I taught fifth grade for 3 years, and it was the summertime. And I wasn't going back in the fall because I was having a baby. And I just wanted something creative to do. And I made myself a diaper bag because I was going to need one in a few months, and posted pictures on Facebook of it. And my friends were like, oh, that's so cute. You should sell it on Etsy. And so I was like, oh, that's easy. Sure. So it started as that. And we named it Better Life Bags from the beginning. We were giving microloans through Kiva at the time and sending a picture of who that loan was going towards with the product. So it was kind of marrying the product and the person that the life was hopefully being better made better for.
So it did have very good intentions right from the outset.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you weren't living in Michigan at the time, were you?
No, we were in Savannah, Georgia.
And what brought you to Hamtramck?
Yeah, so my husband and I are Christ followers, and we wanted to be in a neighborhood where there was different ethnicities, where people looked different than us, so that we could really practice what it means to love your neighbor. And so somehow my husband heard about Hamtramck and heard that it was very diverse, and so we just moved, like, on a whim. We never visited first. We just decided to come, and 7 years later, here we are.
And Michigan is your home. When did you start thinking, you know, I could use some help?
3 years in. So 4 years ago is when I called up Nadia, and some bloggers had pinned one of our bags on a Pinterest, and it just kind of exploded from there.
It's an amazing lesson in the power of social media.
Social media has been, yeah, the key for our business. And it was too busy for me. I mean, I had two kids at that time now, so I was trying to do all this during their nap times and their bedtimes, and I either had to shut it down and say, like, that was fun, or I had to outsource it overseas, maybe, if I wanted it to be huge and big, or there was this third option of hiring someone that I knew, who I knew how to sew. And Nadia and I weren't actually very good friends at the time. We were just maybe acquaintances, I guess. I knew that she knew how to sew, and that's what I needed.
And Nadia, at the time then, you were home caring for how many children?
I have four children.
So you're busy. So this was great, wasn't it? Because you could do the work at home?
Yeah.
What did you think when you got offered a job, when Rebecca called you and said, I think I would like you to help me sew?
Oh, I said, okay, I'm going to try it. I have time for this. I love it. Sewing, I love this because I learned this in my country, in Yemen, how to sew.
I don't think we knew at the time that it was a job. You know, like I didn't call her and be like, do you need a job?
Yeah.
I called her and I was like, I need help.
I need help, Nadia. I said, okay, sure. Let's try. Yeah.
And then you started.
I started with a couple of bags. We start with the small bags. Yeah. After maybe 1 month like this, she started to give me like a big bag, start the inside for it. Mm-hmm. And I make it good. And she said, okay, Nadia, make all the bag for me because I need
so
your help.
Good. Do it all.
Do it all. Yeah.
And at what point, what was it that made you realize, Rebecca, that what you could do was really improve the lives of your neighbors like Nadia?
I didn't think of it as a job. I didn't even really think of the business as a business at the time. It was my hobby. And in order to keep making bags, I needed help. So I don't know, maybe 6 months, I would go to Nadia's house every week. I would bring fabric and then I would pick up what she had done the week before. And then we would just hang out. I would bring my three kids. Okay. Or I guess two kids at the time. It soon became three. And we would just visit and our kids would play together. And
yeah, and then she started to give me back. I started raising my money. And because my husband worked too, but I raised my money because we need more because I have four children for that. I raised my money for those bags I made. Maybe 6 months, I buy a big bunk bed with a big, beautiful like sheet and everything. And then she goes, okay, come see what I bought from what I did from my bags. It's a beautiful bank bed. She saw it.
Yeah. And that gave you a new
that's
view.
When it really clicked for me that, oh, like their family now can afford things that others would seem as just necessities, but they haven't been able to purchase yet. So I was like, I wonder how many other women in our community also need a first or a second income for their families.
And here you are today. Where is the business today? How many employees?
There's 16 of us total. From all different cultures, all different walks of life. It's really fun to walk into our workshop and to see so many different people who look so different, but all in the same little small space. And
how many bags a month do you ship out?
About 400 to 500 a month.
This has grown
an awful
lot from
it's
that cute
hobby.
Etsy hobby, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And how do you find your employees, Rebecca?
Every woman who works there has their own story of how they fell into Better Life Bags. Like, for example, one woman, her name is Cassandra, and she is an inner city mom, four kids, single. I ran into her literally on the street. She was asking for money for diapers for her baby. And our babies actually were at this same age. We were both pushing them in strollers. And I said, well, why don't you come work for a couple hours just cutting some scraps for us, and then I'll give you, you know, what you earn for the day. And now 2.5 years later, she's full-time working, and it just kind of stuck. And so that's one story, and then, you know, everyone has their own story.
Nadia, what is your favorite thing about this job? Because it is a job now that you have. It's
not
a friendship.
Job. No, it's a job.
But what's your favorite thing about working for Better Life Bags?
I like because if you see before, I have a lot of time, like when my kids go to school or something. I don't have nothing to do. Staying at home, like, I can do nothing. Now I'm working, raise some money to help, like, my poor children. It's fun.
Made friends, too.
Yeah.
Yes. And what about you? Your favorite thing? What are you most proud of with this business you've built, Rebecca?
I think what keeps me going in every day is the fact that it has a purpose and it has a mission. And I think my thing I'm most proud of is all the different cultures that have come, and we've broken down stereotypes, and we're breaking down walls, and we're seeing each other as people instead of, you know, colors of skin or cultures. We're all women, and we're all, most of us are moms, and we're all going through the same thing, even though we look different.
And I have to say, I looked on the website. I went to your website, betterlifebags.com, and a few of us were looking going, these bags are awesome. You have so many options, and I know you have the option of, like, a customer can design their own, or there are the ready to ship. They're done, they're ready.
Yeah.
But they're beautiful bags. But and you also slip a message into each bag, don't you?
Yeah. We put the seamstress's name. We say, your bag was made by, and then it's their name. It's like, because of your purchase, she is able to have honor, feel respect, and provide for her family.
Well, you can check out the huge array of purses and backpacks and bags, all being made by Rebecca, Nadia, and the other women of Better Life Bags. Again, the website is betterlifebags.com, and you can also find them on Facebook at Better Life Bags. Rebecca Smith and Nadia Alakil, it is wonderful to meet both of you, and congratulations on the success of Better Life Bags and what you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. And if you miss any part of today's show, it's very easy to find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcast to find the link.
Creation.
Part of the community. The next idea.
It doesn't always look like the dots connect, but they do.
Say you're lucky enough to own a piece of property in Michigan. Would you rather walk through that property wondering about but not knowing what grows there or flies through or lives there? Or would you rather know what's on your land because you've invited biologists to come out and inventory those plants and animals? Our latest contributor to The Next Idea has come up with an idea to do this. Rate My Land, a way to document biodiversity on private lands. Derek Shields, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thanks, Cindy, for having me.
What inspired you to come up with the Rate My Land idea and website?
Well, I've always had a passion for conservation, and we've always wanted to get engaged and be more involved in conservation. It was in grad school that I was going through scientific literature and kept coming across this problem in conservation biology of private lands and private landowners. And in some cases, they're using the word as a roadblock. And I thought, private landowners, they love their land. I can't imagine that they are truly a roadblock. And that was kind of the start, the beginning of the idea of Rate My Land, that maybe they just need to be invited. Maybe there needs to be a special invitation and call for landowners to be part of the solution and not part of the problem. And so 5 years later, I believe that even more strongly now than I did then.
How does Rate My Land work? Take us through it.
Rate My Land is a tool to invite landowners to be part of the conservation picture. It is a website, www.ratemyland.com, that talks about the value of biodiversity surveys, the value of knowing the plants and animals that are on our property, and how that can help conservation and then help you to have a greater connection of your land. Rate My Land is an education tool, and it's also a liaison to professional biologists who can conduct Rate My Land surveys on their property. Surveys range from surveys of the plants on your property to surveys of the herpetofauna, the amphibians, reptiles, to surveys of insects on your property. And so the Rate My Land consultant would conduct the survey and have a relationship with the landowner. And then there's an opportunity for the landowners to have their scores for the property posted on the Rate My Land website. And Rate My Land has a social media field to connect landowners with a community of other landowners who value knowing the plants and animals on their property.
Why is it so significant for us to understand what kinds of plants and animals are on my piece of property?
It's hard to manage and steward species or habitats when you don't know what you have. You know, the basis to conserving plants and animals begins with an understanding of biodiversity, an understanding of what's there on your property. The information gathered through a survey is a starting point to creating a management plan or a stewardship plan for your land. And, you know, that data allows for informed decision-making and can help direct, you know, different actions you want to take or implement on your land.
Derek, how much of Michigan's land is privately owned?
In Michigan, the majority of our land is privately owned, about 72%, so a significant majority of our land. And that's comparable to all states east of Mississippi. I think the figure for land east of Mississippi is that 87% of the land is privately owned. So that's a lot of private property.
Yeah, the kind of biologists don't know what's happening, so this was a way to do that. But why do you think it is, Derek, that private landowners frequently really don't know very much at all about the plant and animal species on their own land?
Well, I think, you know, private landowners do care about their land and value it, but it takes work. There's over 16,000 plants in Michigan, so it takes work to identify and know a plant. And it looks like a wall of green sometimes when you're walking down the trail, and it's kind of intimidating to try to pick out and then learn and memorize, in some cases, a plant's name. And so I think that's one barrier. You know, the other barrier is the time commitment to learning those. But I think when a landowner is given the opportunity to start learning some names, they are connected to that plant and have a greater understanding and appreciation for those walks down their trails.
So if I got up to ratemyland.com and I decide, yes, I do want to have a consultant come check out my land, how does that work? Am I going to pay for that? Does it all happen through the website? What are the details?
Yes, on the Rate My Land website, there is a list of consultants who will offer their services to conduct Rate My Land survey. And I encourage landowners to just reach out and talk to a consultant and see what services they offer and have them help you and figure out what it is you want on your land. And again, the starting point is, what is it you have on your land? What animals and plants are using your land? And then you can start to make plans and set goals. And so I encourage dialoguing with a consultant and seeing what fees they offer. And so the relationship is going to be between the landowner and the consultant. Rate My Land is really just the invitation, the call, and then the go-between, connecting landowners to consultants.
Now, Derek, I can imagine some people, landowners, might be hearing us talk about this and think, well, wait a minute. What if there's an endangered species or something on my property? Will there suddenly be people telling me what I can and cannot do with my property? I mean, could you address that concern?
Yeah, you know, we need to uphold private property rights. We need to uphold the balancing of private property rights with managing species in very interconnected and interdependent landscapes. Rate My Land acknowledges that and really respects private property. In most cases, if there is a listed species, a threatened or endangered species on the property, that does not restrict the private landowner. In most cases, it provides more opportunities, in fact. You know, we have grant agencies, we have Fish and Wildlife Service has programs for landowners who have federal list of species where there's actually money to do land management on properties if you have a threatened list of species. And so the idea of Rate My Land is to kind of turn the page on that perspective. Having a threatened or endangered species could actually be an asset, a value to doing more on your land, providing new resources and new opportunities. And so the cases of actually a threatened endangered species restricting what you can do in the land for a private family landowner is there's very few cases of that. You know, maybe if you were putting up a condominium or a large project, there might be some more cases.
Derek, in your essay, you write that you believe Michigan can lead the nation in fostering this biodiversity value for our land. What does that ultimately mean in a payoff for the state and for the landowners?
Well, Michigan is blessed with abundant natural resources. You know, these natural resources are the anchor to our tourism economy. Well, such a large portion of the state privately owned, private landowners have a role to play in keeping our lands full of living creatures and keeping them healthy. You know, conservation requires many hands, and it requires private landowners getting involved. And if a private landowner is taking initiative for their own private land, and as a whole, all landowners doing that, we're going to together keep Michigan beautiful and healthy. And I would also add that many talented and skilled field biologists are graduating from our universities and colleges in Michigan, and they're not finding jobs. Jobs are few and far between. And private landowners can provide them with opportunities. At least what I envision, where consultants graduating biologists with this skill set of field biology can be hired by private landowners, and we can keep that skill set alive and viable in our state. Together as a whole, we're going to continue to protect beautiful Michigan.
Derek Shields is the creator of Rate My Land. You can get details at ratemyland.com. And his essay can be found on the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. Please share your thoughts in the comments section there or on Michigan Radio's Facebook page or Twitter at Next Idea MI. Derek Shields, thank you so much for making us newly aware of the importance of the private landowners in helping protect Michigan's biodiversity. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Monday, and that means it's time for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. So, how about those Tigers?
We have been riding the Tigers roller coaster all summer long. I have registered my concerns at several points, of course. They've won 8 of the last 10, 6 in a row, and they are now a half game out of the wild card with the Boston Red Sox, which will get you into the playoffs. They are 4.5 behind the Cleveland Indians, so that's not very likely, but you face them in late September, 3 games. So right now, everything's still possible, incredibly, and they're playing very good baseball.
Well, and what is working? Is it hitting? Is it pitching? Is it gelling as a team?
The answer, Cindy, is yes.
To all of the above, huh?
To win in baseball or most sports, you have to do, you know, offense, defense, and camaraderie and all that stuff. To lose, all you need is one of those things to fail. That's the horrible part, of course. And for the Tigers, that has usually been pitching and especially, of course, relief pitching, where somebody has a great game going, like Verlander for 3 7-innings. They bring in a guy from the bullpen, and he promptly blows a 3 or 4 run lead. It happens all summer long. But right now, it's working.
Is it more that alchemy that turns a team from struggling into winning, that idea that winning just breeds more winning?
It was Ernie Harwell who told me he believed that chemistry came after winning. When you start winning, we all get along really well. So maybe that's how it works.
Now, today's the trade deadline. Any thoughts? What do the Tigers need to do, should do, and will do?
They are in the hunt, it sounds like, for a 3rd or 4th starting pitcher. Not a headliner that'll cost a ton of money. Merely a 3rd or 4th one that'll cost half a ton of money. Of course, these days it's all outrageous. Yeah. But that is my most likely guess.
Got to switch over to Michigan football, but in particular, this switch from Adidas back to Nike. Help us, if you can, the rest of us, understand why it is a thing that had people lining up for hours and hours for the midnight opening of MDN.
Cindy, I wish I could. I must not be their target audience because I don't get it. State Street in Ann Arbor last night was packed. It's at 12:01. Michigan's allowed to sell Nike stuff. That's when the contract starts, August 1st, of course. It was the Art Fair times something.
Wow.
It was just crazy. And here's what I don't get, old man that I am now, apparently. Look, man, it's not like fresh fruit or a rock concert that you can't see tomorrow. You know, it's shirts, it's sweats, it's all stuff. It's all going to be there tomorrow. Same prices, I believe. The MDN site has crashed repeatedly. The demand is so high.
But why?
I'm not 18. I can't tell you.
I know Jim Harbaugh was there and Ward Manuel was there.
Well,
so it's marketing.
It's marketing. And yeah. Smart for Nike, smart for Michigan, of course. And look, all this stuff, by the way, is made. Reebok, Nike, and Adidas are all made in the same factories, the exact same factory in China. So the workmanship has got to be, I believe, the same. Put a swoosh on one and 3 strips in the other, and that's the difference. But I will tell you, for recruiting and for merchandising, it makes a huge difference. Nike is apparently a whole lot cooler than Adidas to a recruit or to a college student, the people who buy this stuff. And therefore, Nike's bet has already paid off, and Michigan's bet on Harbaugh has already paid off. So they're not getting this contract without the guy in khakis. So the finances for Michigan and for Nike have already won.
Speaking of the guy in khakis, you were in Chicago for Big Ten Media Days,
right.
And you said MSU and Michigan made some splashes. So what did you hear? Well, let's first talk about the guy in khakis in Michigan.
It's the Harbaugh effect. Wherever he goes, the camera's going to be rolling, whether he – I don't know if he really cares about it or not, either way, to be honest. The most common question I got from friends of mine was, you know, is he like this all the time? Is it the real him? And the answer is yes and yes. And that, to me, is always, as I've been saying, his saving grace is that that is utterly who Jim is. That is completely authentic. Whether you like it or not, he's going to keep on doing it. And for the most part, certainly Michigan fans love it.
Did you hear anything during Big Ten Media Days that gave you a sense of what fans can look forward to in the fall?
Look at the stats the past 5 years. When's the last time we got it right across the board? Mm-hmm. We never do. Right now, Ohio State, to me, is the best team in the Big Ten. They're just reloading, not rebuilding. Michigan, however, out in Vegas, is the number one bet to be the national champion this coming year, which only tells you how much money and enthusiasm Michigan fans have.
What about Mark D'Antonio and the Spartans? What'd you hear?
He's rock solid. Look, I mean, nobody is better than taking the continual disrespect that he receives and turning it into fuel better than Mark D'Antonio, and he's done a great job of that again.
We can't talk about the Spartans without taking note of the terrible, sad loss of former Spartan punter Mike Sadler, killed along with Nebraska's punter Sam Fultz in that car crash in Wisconsin. They had a big ceremony yesterday at Spartan Stadium, but boy, this was a kid that clearly meant a lot to Spartan Nation.
Clearly did, and look, punters can be part of the team or not part of a team. It depends on kind of who they are. This guy was deeply integrated. First of all, he's a brainiac. He's going to Stanford Law School, Michigan State's first four-time academic All-American, and I thought D'Antonio handled that extremely difficult situation exactly right, which is hard to do. You don't want to turn it into win-win for the Gipper and rah-rah, it's about football, because it's not about football. He contained his comments to the young man himself, his family, and what he meant to the team.
Indeed. Michigan Radio sports commentator John Ubig. As always, thanks, John.
Thank you, Cindy.
Intelligence. It's certainly something you'd like to think you possess and something that America in 2016 really, really prizes. But exactly what is intelligence? And who decides who's intelligent and who's not? Michigan State University professor of psychology Zach Hambrick directs the Expertise Lab at MSU. He is here with us now. And Zach, as we talk about intelligence and just what that is, let's frame it first by talking about meritocracy. What is that, and do we live in one in 2016 America?
Well, a meritocracy is the idea that your accomplishments reflect your abilities and your effort, so you get what you work for, rather than birth status through no effort of our own.
And is America in 2016, is that us?
Well, I think that's a tough question. I mean, what we do know from research on intelligence and in psychology is that scores on intelligence tests, whatever they reflect, and there is a debate about that, but whatever they reflect, they correlate with and they predict success, for example, in the workplace and the classroom. Now, it's certainly not the whole story. It's one piece of the puzzle. Other factors matter too, but we have a lot of confidence that scores on intelligence tests do in fact predict important outcomes.
Well, when we say intelligence, what is that exactly?
Well, you ask 100 different psychologists what intelligence is, and you're going to get 100 somewhat different definitions, but there's some consistent themes in the way that psychologists think about intelligence. It encompasses the ability to learn from experience, the ability to solve problems, the ability to adapt to new situations, and it also comprises what we know. This is both sort of our expertise in specific domains, and it could also include sort of general knowledge of the world.
And you made a little aside as you talked about intelligence tests and the scores. Is that what we use to decide whether someone is intelligent or not? Is that the commonly accepted way of deciding whether you are and I'm not?
When we get down to measuring intelligence and to actually using intelligence to predict things like possible success in the workplace or the classroom, I mean, yes, that's what we call an operational definition. It's a measurable aspect of behavior that we say indexes or represents some construct like intelligence. And so, yes, in one sense, when we talk about intelligence, we are talking about scores on intelligence tests.
What are they missing? What do those scores miss?
They miss what we call non-ability characteristics. This includes motivation, for one. And research suggests what I think we all sort of know from everyday observation, and that is that motivation is certainly an important part of our success in the world. It also relatedly misses personality characteristics, like how conscientious we are in our work, independent of our sort of ability, misses things like how open we are to new experiences, how agreeable we are in social interactions. So this all is sort of under the umbrella of non-ability characteristics. That's, in a nutshell, what intelligence tests miss.
Writer David Friedman made an interesting case in a recent piece he wrote for The Atlantic that more and more he believes American society mistakes intelligence for human worth. What are your thoughts about that?
Unfortunately, I think there may be some truth to that. And I certainly don't think, and I think there are very few, if any, intelligence researchers who would say that your score on an intelligence test is a measure of your worth. One way to think about it is this is another thing that intelligence tests miss. that certainly is important in life. Again, at the risk of belaboring the point, mm-hmm. intelligence tests don't capture everything that matters for worldly success, however you want to define that. I mean, there's certainly more to the puzzle, but it does appear to be an important piece of the puzzle.
In that piece for The Atlantic, Friedman puts out a case that he believes people who would never, ever, ever think of degrading someone on the basis of race or physical appearance have no problem labeling and degrading others with that S word, the stupid word. Do you buy into that? And do you think that's...
I think unfortunately that there's some truth to that. And that's just mean-spirited. One of the things we know about scores on intelligence tests, intelligence, is that maybe to some degree it's under our control when we talk about knowledge mm-hmm. as being a component of intelligence. What we learn and what we choose to learn and how much we learn is to some degree perhaps a reflection of something that we can control. But then we also know from many decades of research now that differences across people – our intelligence test scores are at least partly due to genetic factors. And this is something that there's not even really any serious debate about it anymore. So it depends on who you ask, but estimates of the heritability of intelligence, which is heritability refers to the contribution of differences that's due to genetic factors, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 70%, okay?
Boy, so pick your family well.
Well, and yeah, I mean, we don't control our genetic makeup. We come into the world with it. I think part of the focus on intelligence and sort of the mean-spiritedness mm-hmm. surrounding it is really unfortunate. Intelligence isn't a measure of a person's worth. It is a piece of information that can be used in certain situations to make predictions about how people will behave, but it's just one part of the puzzle.
Are we, as a nation, taking ourselves down a questionable moral path by making it so easy to sneer at, quote, stupid people by prizing intelligence above all else? Are there moral questions here?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are, as there would be for, you know, denigrating someone based on any characteristic. You know, the question is whether we think that's right or wrong. And so, yeah, I think there is certainly a moral dimension to this. And I think that, as is often the case, when somebody maligns somebody else based on some characteristic, that reflects ignorance on the part of the person who's doing the maligning. Mm-hmm. One might be simply overestimating the importance of intelligence. Another is not realizing or appreciating the fact that our intelligence is not completely under our control. As I said before, we can do things to improve ourselves intellectually. You can read,
yes.
right? You can listen to people with different viewpoints. You can expose yourself to different cultures so you won't turn into a bigot, right?
Right.
But then again, I mean, there are aspects of cognitive functioning, and that's essentially what we're talking about, mm-hmm. which, of course, is rooted in brain function. We don't control. It's influenced by our genetic makeup. We know, related to this, that intelligence test scores are highly stable across the lifespan. They're not completely stable. In other words, there's some movement.
I can't study my way to a much higher IQ.
Well, that's a hotly contested question. But what we do know is a person's score in childhood on an intelligence test is going to be a pretty good indication of their score in later adulthood. There's been excellent research done at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland establishing this with very large samples of people over a 50-year, 60-year span.
A good study.
Right.
Good study.
You know, I think that making fun of someone's intelligence sort of falls into the category of making fun of people based on other characteristics that they can't control. It's mean-spirited.
Zach, how do you differentiate between intelligence and talent?
I would think of intelligence as one form of talent. So it's sort of intellectual talent. And we can think of other forms or aspects of talent like physical abilities.
What kind of questions do you tackle in your work in the expertise lab?
One of the main questions that we're interested in is why some people are able to become so much more highly skilled at things than other people. And this is in a wide range of domains, everything from sports and academics to games like chess, music. Music is something that we study in the lab. I think we've all noticed that it's rather obvious that some people are a lot better in these domains than others. And we have extreme examples of this in terms of, professional athletes and, professional musicians and so forth. And so what we're really focused on understanding are the origins of variation across people, individual differences in expert performance. Why is it the case that some people are so much more highly skilled than others? And we look at a wide range of factors. We look at certainly training history. No one would deny that to make it to the Olympics, let's say, you have to train. People aren't born with a sort of specialized knowledge and skills that is necessary for world-class performance. Okay, so training history is part of the puzzle. But we also look at a range of other factors. So basic abilities and capacities, sort of what you could consider different aspects of talent. We also look at developmental factors like when a person starts in a domain. There's evidence that sort of independent of having an opportunity to gain more training, there's an advantage in some domains of starting earlier as opposed to later.
Could it inform the way we educate our kids, kind of work you're doing?
Yes. Part of it, again, is focusing on training, and we'd like to understand training conditions that lead to optimal performance. We're also interested in identifying characteristics of people like basic cognitive abilities and physical and perceptual abilities that forecast someone's success above and beyond training. The promise of this is being able to give people specific information about domains in which they might be likely to excel, and then also tailoring training regimens in light of a person's profile of abilities and other characteristics.
Interesting work. In the meantime, if America as a society could get rid of that pejorative S word, I think we'd all be better off, is what I think
right.
I hear you saying.
Yeah, I would say that, certainly we all from time to time make decisions that we call stupid, right?
Mm-hmm.
Politicians seem especially prone to them, or maybe it's just they're in the public's eye.
It's true. We see them very vividly.
Right. But again, this sort of labeling people as opposed to their occasional decisions as stupid is harmful.
Zach Hambrick is a professor of psychology at Michigan State University. You can learn more about the work of the Expertise Lab by going to their website, scienceofexpertise.com. Zach, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Our engineer today was Mike Blank. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.